Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. Before we begin, I'd just like to note briefly that we have Judge Sparks joining us by phone, and we have Senior Judge Efron joining us as the fifth judge. The first case today is United States v. Quezada. Commander Moore, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir. We argue.
And Lieutenant Joseph, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efron, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Daniel Moore. I represent the appellant in this case, Lance Corporal Jonathan Quezada. Mr. Chief Judge, I respectfully request 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
The military judge's false exculpatory statement instruction in this case gave the denial of the sex act in this case an outsized relevance to the members. Without further tailoring, the members were permitted to use the denial of the sex act as evidence the sex act occurred. In the context of this trial, members could have easily understood that to mean that the military judge's instruction to mean that if Lance Corporal Quezada was guilty of a 107, then he could have been guilty of the 120 as well, therefore undermining the presumption of innocence. This court should find that the lack of tailoring and the instruction itself were error that was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and should overturn the lower court's conviction because the instruction invited the members to prove the sex act in this case in a circular manner. The lower court and the government's focus on cases that did not involve the accused being charged for denial of misconduct and underlying misconduct missed the point in this case, and they overlooked how the interaction of the charging scheme and the instruction could work to undermine the presumption of innocence. There's a focus on general versus specific denials in this case, and that is a distinction that a layman cannot be expected to make unless instructed to do so. And that is...
Now, counsel, you were just referring to the circular nature of this.
Yes.
And, in fact, a significant part of your brief is talking about the circularity problem, as you define it. I'm just wondering about that premise. Now, why couldn't it be a situation where the panel members here would say, in light of the DNA evidence, that there was a false statement by appellant in regard to claiming that there was no sexual contact? But that does not mean that there was the sexual offense because it was consensual. So why doesn't that break the chain of circularity that you're concerned about?
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't break the chain of circularity because what we're dealing with is, although we're not dealing with a general denial like in COCO, what we're dealing with is we're dealing with the denial of the actus reus of a specific intent crime. And because we're dealing with the actus reus of a specific intent crime, it is closer to a general denial than the category of false exculpatory statements in the case law that consists of either some sort of a false alibi or some sort of story that is just ultimately too good to be true. And because we are dealing with such an important element of the offense, in order for the members to make a determination of whether that statement is false, then they have to go look to whether or not it happened in the first place. Again, the denial being evidence that it could have happened.
But is it really evidence of guilt as compared to an inference that can be made about the consciousness of guilt? So again, why does that necessarily compel us to conclude that this was improper, how the military judge instructed on this?
I think, again, it goes to the concept of an outsized relevance of that act, and given the interaction of the act and the charging scheme and the instruction itself. Ultimately, what the members were told is they may infer that an innocent person doesn't normally necessarily feel the need to invent a story or fabricate a story that supports their innocence. But at the same time, that exact denial was also the subject of two charges in this case. And because that exact denial was the subject of two charges in this case, some form of further tailoring should the instruction having been given, some form of tailoring needed to take place in order to give the members the correct, proper tool to apply that to the offenses.
So you say some type of tailoring needed to occur. So you're not saying that in these types of cases, false statement could not be charged. You're saying that a military judge, instead, you can still have the false statement charge. You can still have, at the same time that you have the Article 120. You're saying, though, that this court should impose a new requirement for tailoring an instruction?
The court should ultimately, Judge, the instruction should not have been given. And I think this court,
But in terms of that, are you saying then that going forward, the government cannot charge a false statement in these types of offenses?
No, that's not.
So are you saying that the instruction that's been around for a long time is wrong?
No, Let's Corpus out of stance is not that the instruction is wrong. If the instruction is going to be given, there needs to be some form of tailoring to direct the members as to what to do with such powerful instruction, as well as the interaction of the charging scheme and that instruction, such that the subject of the false official statement and the false exculpatory statement and the sex act in Specification Charge 1 are all linked together, and without a layman being told what that linkage means, we run the risk of using the denial in a circular manner to prove that the offense itself.
So what should a judge say?
If the judge, it's less quote because our position that the instruction should not be given. If the instruction were to be given, then.
So just to be clear, you're saying no instruction should be given whatsoever on a offense that has been charged?
No, Your Honor, not that no instruction should be given on the defense that should be charged, but again, going back to page 181 of the Joint Appendix, the defense counsel's objection, the first basis of the objection is confusion between the false exculpatory statement and the 107 charge. So the basis of the objection in this case is why the instruction should not have been given in this case, and again, that goes to in Leyes Corporal Quezada's reply brief, it goes to footnote 6, which follows the Ninth Circuit guidance of leaving this kind of, leaving that to arguments rather than giving the instruction.
So no instruction at all?
The preference would have been not to have given the instruction in this matter or to tailor it. If it had to be given, then it should have been tailored such that, for example, in United States v. Francis, where the accused was charged with a 107 for a conspiracy involving leaking an Air Force promotion standard, that the military judge in that case instructed the members to use the false exculpatory statement instruction as it related to the consciousness of guilt and the intent to deceive element of the 107. Something like that in this case would have given the false exculpatory statement instruction and the false statement itself a relevance tailored to that particular element of the offense. And like you mentioned earlier, Judge, tailoring with regards to 120, something that directed the members to the consent element of the charge, perhaps something along the lines of because of the false exculpatory statement instruction, could be used in regards to the accused mindset as to mistake of fact as to consent.
But counsel, don't we also have precedent that says tailoring the instruction in this manner is somewhat problematic and can create its own error by highlighting certain facts in the record as being more important than others? I mean, this seems like we're creating a landmine for military judges, because you're asking us to create a rule where you have the situation, you have to carefully tailor the instruction. But we also have other precedent out there saying that if you tailor the instruction in the wrong way, you're going to create error.
Yes, sir. We do have it. We do have, from Apalka, we do have the precedent that says that tailoring can, leave the phrase, bolster the government's argument. And in that case, it would have given the facts of that case. The facts of that case were essentially there was physical evidence on a stolen good that made it clear that any other explanation that Emmett Apalka would have given would obviously have been an explanation designed to make him look more innocent. Whereas in United States v. Francis, we have a course of conduct of an accused that makes him look more innocent. So in that regard, the false exculpatory statement instruction didn't bolster. But it's ultimately a case-by-case analysis. And the facts here, again, because we're dealing with a denial of such a critical element of the offense, that tailoring here and even directing the members to what that statement would have been, it's Lance Corporal Quezada's position that on these facts and in this case, that would not have been a bolstering of the government's argument.
And how does the military judge make this distinction between, we've already said you can't charge 107 for a complete denial of the crime, right? You can't create a complete circularity. But if it's only a part of the crime, then it's okay. But now we're creating you're suggesting that we create an additional rule that if you have key elements of the crime or critical elements of the crime, well, you can't charge 107 for that either. How is a military judge supposed to know what is a key element of a crime? It seems like all the elements of a crime are generally key elements.
Well, again, Your Honor, when we're dealing with specific intent crime, there is an actus reus involved. So the denial of the criminal act itself. Lance Corporal Quezada denied the criminal action of which he was accused. So that denial in itself is although not general, is the kind of denial that gets close to the general denial and therefore closer to the problem that this court had laid out in Cole. And close enough.
Well, the denial of having sex really wasn't the offense. It was having non-consensual sex. So I'm not quite sure where this circularity is that you're concerned about arises.
Well, again, it comes from not just the denial, but also the charging scheme. The body of the false official statement was, I did not touch or lick DEA's vagina or words to that effect. The members were told that denial was a false statement. Then there's a false exculpatory statement instruction. Then on page 211 of the joint appendix, the trial counsel, while explaining the false official statement charge to the members, even says, remember what DEA told you. I felt him lick my vagina. I felt his tongue. And then he moves on to discussing that particular charge, that particular specification of the Article 120. And then on page 240 of the joint appendix, the trial counsel again points out the denial. He lists the denials, and one of those denials that he lists is charged conduct. What we're dealing with here is we're dealing with an instruction and a charging scheme that have now made one charge have a bearing on another, and the members have received no instruction on how to handle that. On page 182 of the joint appendix, the military judge offers his rationale for denying the objection in this case to this instruction. He says the evidence is clear that the members can make this distinction. But then he doesn't, there is no instruction to the members to make that distinction. And ultimately, to ask a layman to make that distinction without some sort of instruction, that's not the lucid guidepost for the members to apply the facts to the law that an instruction ought to be.
Counsel, can you clarify one aspect of your brief? You mentioned in a couple places that there was a propensity problem, like in Hills. How does this present a propensity problem? I didn't quite understand that.
Yes, sir. So ultimately, because of the way the charges and the instructions interact, the members, without further tailoring, could find themselves saying, because Lance Corporal Quezada committed the Article 107 in this case on these facts, it is more likely that just based on the Article 107 itself, that he in fact did commit the actus reus in the 120 charge.
So just a general idea that this is a person who commits criminal acts.
Yes, sir.
And can you also say, why didn't the anti-spillover instruction take care of the problem of the interaction between the two offenses?
Yes, sir. The anti-spillover instruction in this case was ultimately was inadequate given the actual text of the charge, the instruction, and then also the 120 charge. The similarities, also just identical acts that were relevant to both charges, the military judge should have given the members a better toolkit with which to analyze how that would affect their deliberations. We don't know. All we know is the members were told that there was a statement that may have been false, and what that false statement means. Well, members were told, given a rationale for why an accused would make that false statement, as far as it related to the charges in this case and what it meant, its relevance, the members were given nothing. So we have no way of knowing, for example, did they start with the 107? Did they start with the 120? We have no way of knowing because they weren't instructed on how to handle the similarities of that instruction and the 107 charge, and then the charge act in the 120.
Thank you.
Counsel, are you making an argument that in every case the instruction needs to be tailored if an instruction is given, or are you making an argument that in this case, on behalf of your client, that was necessary to tailor the instruction?
Your Honor, we're making the latter argument, that in this case, on these facts, with Lance Corporal Quezada, the instruction should have been tailored. In response to Judge Hardy's question from earlier, it really is a case-by-case analysis, because what we're dealing with is the interaction of the charging scheme and the instruction itself have caused the problem. Those two factors independently are not problematic. But in this instance, the combination of the two can present a problem to a lay member, and it would be up to the military judge to clear up any confusion. And it is the confusion that the defense counsel noticed immediately when the judge brought up the false exculpatory statement.
Might there be cases in which the defense counsel does not want that instruction to be given, even if it meets facts similar to yours? If the defense counsel were to determine that highlighting that particular matter would not be helpful to the defense, and if the government doesn't particularly want the instruction, or the judge is agreeable, then there would be no instruction. Or alternatively, the judge might decide, despite the defense view, they're going to give the instruction anyway. So how do you suggest that this court approach the question of whether the instruction should be given with or without the initiative of the defense asking for tailoring?
Mr. Chief Judge, I see that my time is...
Please proceed.
So, Judge, to answer your question...
Turn to Judge Sparks and see if he has any questions.
I do agree with the premise that there are cases in which the defense might not want this instruction highlighted. And I think this case started out as a case in which the defense did not want the instruction highlighted. The military judge, in fact, brought this up. The trial counsel did not ask for the instruction. In a case where the defense counsel does not want that conduct highlighted, if the military judge decides that it should be, offered the objection. In the alternative, tailor.
Who's responsible, then, for the initiation of the tailoring? Is it the defense counsel at that point? Is there any responsibility on the defense counsel to suggest how an instruction should be tailored?
Because the defense counsel is the one lodging the objection, then the defense counsel, ability to offer some sort of alternative to not giving the instruction would ultimately be good practice, but the tailoring of that instruction over an objection should ultimately come from the military judge and input from both counsel as to how to avoid either circularity or an instance where outsized relevance of an element could undermine the presumption of innocence of a charge.
And last question, what does the record show us about whether the defense requested tailoring in this case, whether the specific words were going to be offered by the defense counsel or by the judge? What does the record show us about the defense position on tailoring in this case?
The record shows us that the defense's position on tailoring, Judge, was no position. The defense's position in this case was, in fact, to not give the instruction because of the potential to confuse the instruction with the charge itself. And that's a conversation that starts on page 181 of the joint appendix.
Judge Sparks.
I have no questions.
Okay, thank you. He said he has no questions. Lieutenant Joseph.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efron, and members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Jennifer Joseph, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, I represent the United States. This court should affirm for two reasons. First, the false exculpatory statement instruction did not create a Hills error, nor did it violate appellant's presumption of innocence. And second, even if it were error to give the instruction, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. As a preliminary matter, an untailored instruction here, if error, would not have created a Hills-type error. A Hills error involves two things. First, it's when charged conduct is being offered as propensity evidence under MRE 413 or 414. And second, it's when the members are given conflicting standards of proof. Now, Hills-Hips isn't implicated here for three reasons. First, while it is charged conduct at issue, it wasn't being offered as propensity evidence under MRE 413. Second, the members
In that regard, in response to a question from Judge Maggs, appellant's counsel said, well, it really is propensity evidence because you're saying this accused is a criminal. Look, he's committed this offense, a false official statement. What is your response to that argument?
Your Honor, the spillover instruction here was sufficient to instruct the members. It specifically instructed the members that they were not to convict appellant based on a criminal disposition to commit crimes. And the reason was sufficient here and insufficient in Hills is because in Hills, the military judge followed the spillover instruction by saying that they could nevertheless find something by preponderance of the evidence, even if they found some of the elements for the other offenses by something less than beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, the members were only ever instructed on beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's no danger that they were going to convict on something less than beyond a reasonable doubt. So if the effect of the instruction here paired with a 107 charge did, as appellant argues, somehow lead the members to convict on propensity evidence, it wouldn't be a Hills error, but rather a violation of the presumption of innocence. And so to the extent that Hills and its progeny discuss how instructions can violate the presumption of innocence, those cases are instructive. The cases tell us that or emphasize the importance of giving clear instructions on the burden of proof. Prasad tells us that when the military judge clearly instructs on beyond a reasonable doubt, there's not a danger that the members are going to somehow apply something less than beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's true even if the same piece of evidence is being used not only to prove different offenses, but also different elements within each offense. We know that from Hills and Vila.
Now, appellant's counsel says, yes, although there were these instructions out there about offenses needing to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, that it wasn't directly tied to the false official statement in terms of considering it for the purposes of inferring consciousness of guilt. What is your response to that?
So, Your Honor, there isn't a military case other than the Francis case that specifically looked at how this instruction works with a 107 charge. In Francis, they didn't really discuss this potential spillover. However, the Tenth Circuit in Durham looked at the same untailored, a nearly identical untailored instruction that was given here. And in that case, the appellant was charged with conspiracy to distribute cocaine and then later four different counts of perjury based on his testimony at a motions hearing for those initial charges. And so the appellant in Durham alleged that the instruction violated his presumption of innocence in two ways. First, because it somehow directed the jury to find falsity for the perjury charges. And second, that it would bleed over or spill over into them finding guilt or being more likely to find guilt on the conspiracy charges. And in Durham, they ultimately found that the instruction was improper on the merits because it was there were general and not specific denials. But the court said it wasn't error because of the charging scheme. So it wasn't an error because of the interplay that the instruction had with either the perjury or the conspiracy to distribute cocaine charges. And the reason for that is because they noted that the jury was properly instructed on the elements of perjury and to find each one beyond a reasonable doubt. And the function of the false exculpatory statement instruction was only to serve as a permissive inference. They were never required to find falsity.
Counsel, in this case, did the accused make one statement that was the subject of this instruction, or were there more than one statements that were the subject of this instruction?
Your Honor, as far as what was charged, it was...
Not asking about what was charged.
Okay, Your Honor.
I'm asking about this particular instruction about false exculpatory statements. How many statements were at issue?
It is unclear from the record, Your Honor, when the military judge asks trial counsel if they would like it. The only discussion that they have on it is the military judge saying, I do find that statements made in his CID interrogation video give rise to giving the charge. And that's on page 181 of the Joint Appendix, Your Honor.
How would the members know which statements made by the accused were the ones that were related to the charge and which ones might have been false exculpatory statements that were not related to the charge?
Well, Your Honor, I think this gets to Judge Hardy's question on whether or not tailoring is necessary, and specifically whether or not the tailoring of an instruction should highlight specific statements or direct the member's attention to specific statements. Based on cases not only like Opolka and Kokel, not only is tailoring not necessary, it's also ill-advised to the extent that it would bolster the government's argument, particularly when a 107 is charged, to the extent that it may signal to the members that the military judge, in fact, thinks a given statement from the accused is false. Now, that was particularly at issue with Kokel because some of the statements that the members could have applied the instruction to were actually based on his testimony at trial. And so the court in Kokel expressed concern that had the instruction been tailored, it would have had potentially the effect of signaling to the members that the military judge didn't believe the appellant's testimony at trial. And if we're talking about the presumption of innocence, that would be just as problematic to somehow direct the members to presume an element that the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
I appreciate the policy argument, but is your answer to my question, were there more than one statements that could have been considered by the members as false exculpatory statements? Your answer is
Yes, Your Honor, there could have been. There were other statements in the CID interrogation video, such as all I did was lay down next to her, and outside of the context of the video, there were statements. His wife, for example, testified at trial that he had told her the DNA would come back negative.
And for the members to determine which of those statements were made, which of those statements may have been false, and I'm referring now to the ones that were not the subject of the 107 charge, what standard would the members apply in determining that? That is, whether the statement was made and whether it was false.
Well, Your Honor, if they were considering those charges, if they were considering those other statements, the ones not subject to the 107 charge, then they'd really only become relevant for the 120. And we don't, while I can't say that we know that they were considering all of those other statements not subject to the 107 charges beyond a reasonable doubt, we do know that they were only ever instructed on beyond a reasonable doubt.
So they could have decided those then on some evidence, substantial evidence, preponderance of an evidence, clear and convincing evidence. We could come up with lots of other standards, but what happens in the deliberation room when they're trying to decide whether or not the statement was made, the statement was false, and the third aspect of it, was it exculpatory? There are at least three things they have to decide. What standard do they use?
So, Your Honor, our position is that for the other statements, we don't need it's not problematic that we don't know based on the record that there potentially could have been some other standard that they were applying. As in Prasad, when they are only instructed on beyond a reasonable doubt, we're going to presume that the members applied beyond a reasonable doubt to every element. Now, as far as the 107 charges, there's no danger because they knew that when they were to determine the falsity of, no, I did not lick or touch her vagina, they had to find that beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the element of the 107 charge. With respect to the 120s, finding falsity is not an element of, it's not an express element of the 120. So there's no reason to presume that they found the 120s by something, any element of the 120 by something less than beyond a reasonable doubt.
I understand your argument that you're making with respect to what may have been the particular, what's your argument with respect to the granted issue in this case. But we're dealing with an instruction which has been mentioned, has been blessed over and over again. And what my question is exploring is, let's look at that instruction. Is that instruction that's useful? Is that an instruction that's useful if we don't know whether the members are deciding whether something is true or false, whether it's exculpatory or not, and the members are sent into the deliberation room? Don't know what statements are at issue, they're going to have to identify the statement and then make all those judgments without knowing what standard to use?
So, Your Honor, Durham's discussion of the order of operations of how this instruction works is useful, and that is that the instruction doesn't become relevant until the members already conclude that a statement is false. Now, in the realm of 107, they know they have to do that beyond a reasonable doubt. To the extent that Your Honor is asking about the utility of this instruction, the Durham Court understands that it only becomes relevant once they determine it's false. So in the 107, it only comes into play once they've determined the falsity elements, and then the implication is that it must be being used for the intent to deceive element.
Right, because I'm asking about the non-107.
This case
involved multiple statements that were considered to be false, only one of which is related apparently to the 107. Is that an instruction that we should continue to perpetuate?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the 120s where falsity is not an express element, another thing that the members were instructed on is that there may be other facts that the members can consider that aren't elements of the offense that may not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But that doesn't suggest to the members that to find the appellant either guilty or innocent, if they find him guilty on the 120, they know every element of the 120 has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And so their determination of other statements made wouldn't undercut their duty or their obligation or their understanding of their obligation to find every element of the 120 beyond a reasonable doubt. So the utility of the instruction there may be, and I think this goes to Chief Judge Olson's questions about there being other elements of the 120, namely consent or not, their determination of the falsity of the other statements might go to their determination of finding the consent element beyond a reasonable doubt.
So in your view, let me see if I capture this, the members in a non-107 statement could use a low standard, like some evidence, to determine that a statement is false, that in a statement is exculpatory, and use that to draw an inference about whether someone is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, no, Your Honor, not some evidence. The only standard of proof they were ever given here is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right, that's proof as to the element, but in terms of determining whether something is false or exculpatory, those are not elements of the offense. Those are segments of the false explanatory statement.
I think the reason that it works here, Your Honor, is because this still is a permissive inference. It is not one that is legally required. This wasn't cited in the government's brief, but the Supreme Court case of Francis v. Franklin has some helpful language on the difference between what would be a violative direction to the members and what is merely a permissive inference. A permissive inference doesn't violate the Due Process Clause because it never lessens the government's burden to prove to the jury that they still should find whatever that make that permissive inference. And so here, the false exculpatory statement only ever functions as the permissive inference, which is one of the key reasons why the Durham Court found that there was no overlapping issue or interplay issue between the charging scheme and the instruction for perjury, which is essentially our 107, and the underlying offenses. So to conclude on that point.
Before you do that,
yes,
may I just ask whether Judge Sparks has any questions?
No, Chief, I don't. Thank you.
Please proceed, Lieutenant Joseph.
Thank you. Because the instructions as a whole clearly instructed the members on beyond a reasonable doubt, there was not a chance that the members used this evidence somehow to convict on a propensity basis. So there was no error.
Counsel, I have a question. I know you didn't try this case and you didn't draft the charge sheet, so it's a little bit unfair, but you're here on behalf of the government, so I'm going to ask you anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have the situation where we've got a 107 charge that overlaps with some of the elements of other charge conduct, right? And it creates a whole raft of problems, right? We wouldn't be here if the 107 charge didn't exist. And it seems, looking at the charge, it's a relatively minor offense compared to some of the other offenses charged. What is the government? Why is it important? Now, the appellant hasn't asked us to say that you can't do this, but he arguably could have. What is the government's position on why it's important to bring 107 charges when those charges involve statements that overlap with elements of other charged conduct? Because it seems like it just creates a whole bunch of problems and doesn't give much to the government.
Well, Your Honor, the United States is free to charge with whatever the evidence reasonably supports. And here, the 107 charge was supported. Now, particularly on the facts of this case, where consent, at least by the defense's theory, was highlighted as kind of being the central theme, it could be possible that the members didn't convict on the 120 charge, but may have convicted on the 107 charge. So to the extent that it's within it's permissible for the government to charge as much as within reason, to charge all what the facts support. The facts did support charging that here, Your Honor.
Right, because we're really close. We're not quite to the point of total circularity, but we're really close to that point where we charged him with doing something, and then we charged him with denying doing it, right? Which is what we have rules against that, and here we don't quite have that situation. So I don't think we do because we don't have all the elements covered. But I just don't really understand what this gets the government, why the government brings these charges to the jury when it just creates a whole raft of problems.
And Your Honor, just so I'm understanding, I guess the call of your question is your question about the giving this instruction or the charging scheme itself?
I understand why you would originally bring the charges, but to bring them all the way through trial and to present to the jury this question of did he commit this crime and did he lie about it, what the appellant, I think, rightfully calls a critical element of the crime is just something. I don't see the benefit of doing that, and there's all kinds of potential downsides. That's all. That's the only point I really wanted to make.
I understand your point, and to the extent that there is a concern over, and I see that I'm running out of time, Chief Judge, if I may briefly conclude.
Please do.
To the extent that it could have created problems, what the problem that it didn't create was the members using the 107 as propensity for the 120, or the 120 as the propensity for the 107. If I may briefly conclude, this court should affirm that this court could be confident that even if this instruction were given in error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and thus the United States respectfully asks this court to affirm. Thank you.
Lieutenant Commander Moore.
Thank you. Just briefly, to answer Senator Jeffron's question, there was no standard given to the members about what to do with any of these statements, let alone the four statements that were not charged, the one statement that was charged. There was no standard given at all. At least in Hills, there was a standard given. The members had no such guidance here. What the members were told was that there was a denial to NCIS, and they looked at charge two and saw that the denial to NCIS was highlighted, obviously, as the denial to that particular agent. Then the members were also told that Lance Corporal Quezada's words themselves were incriminating, and obviously then given that charge to read.
To draw on the question I asked further about the tailoring, in this case, was there any request from the defense regarding the standard that should be used?
No request from the defense, because it was the defense's position to not give the instruction at all, given the potential to confuse. And briefly, the United States had relied on the United States Escogin. That was even a case in which the statements were at least highlighted. There was some sort of direction given. Here, there were none, and the statements themselves were part of the government's argument. And again, as this court held, the United States versus Prasad, in the context of evaluating the error here, the government's evidence has to be overwhelming. The government's case consisted of a complaining witness, DEA, who destroyed evidence after being told that evidence was important and needed to be preserved. She recanted her story, and the record itself is inconsistent with the government's theory that her family was not supportive of her when there was a past history of abuse in that family, and the family's actions in this case were to support her in making her claim. Even Lance Corporal Quezada's wife at the time even divorced him over this act. So the idea that she was some victim who was alone and forced to recant, that's not actually supported by the record and the facts of this case. And just briefly, the government's allusions to Durham, that was a perjury charge for lying about for lying in a venue hearing. So again, in terms of how the First Circuit discusses in Littlefield the differences in the kinds of false exculpatory statements that an accused can give, denying being in the venue would be more along the lines of those collateral matters that are just designed to make the accused look more innocent or to, again, fabricate that story as opposed to denial of an act that is charged, as in this case.
Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
I do not, Chief Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:45.